found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to The Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
And welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for joining us. It's Wednesday, April 24th. You're listening to LATalkRadio.com, also the MariaSanchezShow.com, and we appreciate your ears. If you're listening to us live, you know how to do that. You went to LATalkRadio.com and you clicked Listen Now. If you're listening later, that means that you either went to LATalkRadio.com and you downloaded the podcast. And there is a free app that you can get that will allow you to listen on your iPhone or your Android so that you don't really have any reason not to tune in and hear the program. And we thank you for joining us because it's a real thrill to be here. Want to have you check out our blog. It's still a little bit under construction. It went live earlier this week. That's why we've been flying under the radar this week, is just to make sure that all the details were in place. Because one of my mottos is you don't get a second chance to make a good first impression. So MariaSanchezShow.com or TheMariaSanchezShow.com. One is a website, the other is a blog. Also, if you don't mind, you could like the Facebook page of TheMariaSanchezShow.com. We'd appreciate that. We've got a YouTube channel that we're going to be transferring. We had about 100 hours worth of interviews on television on Ustream that we're going to be transferring over to YouTube. You can also follow us on Twitter at Maria Sanchez Show. So we're going to let the world know about our program on Friday. So that's why we're flying quietly. People have been saying to me, those that I know best know that this has been happening. And they're like, I haven't seen anything. I haven't heard anything. I went to the website. There was hardly anything there. And I said, yes, by design. So just an overview of the program in general, we're going to start out with the five news stories that you should be knowing something about. We will have guests regularly. Today we have visiting with us in just a little bit, Glenn Sachs is his name. He founded or ran an executive director of an organization called Fathers and Family, and he is in defense of fathers and shared parenting. He's no longer doing that, but when he was my men's rights advocate correspondent, that's what he would visit with us on regularly about stories in the news. He feels like that men have been underserved in family courts with visitation and custody, and so he's been a lightning rod for that. His columns have appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the Houston Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, the New York Daily News, the Boston Globe, the Chicago Tribune, and over 100 others. He has done radio and TV appearances, ABC, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, CBS, on and on and on. So he's well respected in the industry, and I'm pleased that he's joining us this morning to let us know what work he has done, maybe some advice for folks going through the family court system, and some of the atrocities that occurred over the years, and what Glenn's organization did to step in and to help out. Tomorrow on our program, on Thursday, we're going to have one of my favorite correspondents. She visits with us once a month. She is an astrosexologist, and she talks about the astrological signs and interpersonal relations. And tomorrow she wanted to visit with us because there's something about a solar eclipse or something with the heavenly bodies. And I'm like, sure, whatever you want, Kiki. Because some of our correspondents are, you know, learned and degreed and preeminent experts in the field, including Friday's correspondent. He is my circumcision correspondent, Stephen Sabota. He's a Harvard Law School graduate, and he started an organization about genital integrity. And then we've got some kooky ones like Kiki. And I have a pet correspondent who, she's got five dogs, and anything you need to know about dogs, she does. Not in the dog whisperer way, but in a way like she cooks their food. They eat freshly made food every day. She bakes their dog biscuits once a week. She goes to a pet acupuncturist if there's issues with her animals. She's very, very resourceful. And one of the reasons we have her on the program is that we're a huge proponent of no-kill shelter adoptions. And if you are looking for a specific breed, you can go to rescue groups of that breed and you can adopt from there. We try to discourage breeders who just do like puppy mills, and especially the puppy mill ones. She adopted a dog from a puppy mill that had like three teeth. It had had 9 litters in 10 years or something, just horrific. So anyway, she's got a big, big heart. So over time, you'll be meeting our correspondents. And the reason we have them in our stable is that when something is in the news within their field of expertise, that's when they come on the program and they visit with us to let us know their perspective on it. So the top stories that you should know about for Wednesday, April 24th, are the memorial service for the MIT campus police officer, Sean Collier. That's happening today. The MIT says they're expecting as many as 10,000 people at the service, which is going to be held at Briggs Field. Police and safety officers are flying in from throughout the country. Vice President Joe Biden, as well as the president of MIT, and Collier's family members are scheduled to speak. He's 27 years old. Authorities think that he was shot and killed by the Boston Marathon bombing suspects last Thursday. He had worked for MIT police for a little over a year, but he was already well respected by his colleagues and superiors and popular with the students. He often went on hikes with the MIT student outing club. And those random, horrible acts of violence, and I guess they weren't that random, were they? They were targeted. I don't know that he was, but he got in the crosshairs somehow. The other story that's in the news and that was happening yesterday is that the elder Sarnia brother his name was listed on our government's highly classified central database of people it views as potential terrorists. But the list is so vast that this did not mean that the authorities automatically kept close tabs on him, and that was shared yesterday. They say that his details were entered into TIDE, that's T-I-D-E, and that's an acronym, and it's Terrorist Identities Data Mart Environment List. And the FBI interviewed him in 2012 because there was a Russian tip-off that the elder Sarnia brother had become a follower of radical Islamists. The FBI said that they did not find him to be an active threat. By the way, this TIDE database has more than 500,000 names on it, and fewer than 5% of the entries were U.S. citizens or legal residents. So TIDE was set up by federal security because of September 11th attacks. And he was not put on the no-fly list, which would have banned him from boarding an airplane in the United States. Neither was he named on the selectee list, which would have required him to be given extra security screening at airports. And I don't know if you've experienced that, but I have. And I guess my name, well, Maria Sanchez is fairly common. It's like Mary Smith, if you will. And I cannot tell you how many times I was randomly selected to go through different kinds of security, and I was, in general, what would happen when I would check in at the airports, they would look at my name, they'd look at my passport, they'd turn off their terminal, they'd say I'd be right back, and they'd go somewhere. So I always had to allow, this is here in the United States, I had to allow for an extra hour because this happened regularly. And I don't fly that much. Last year, 2012, I happened to, because I had some incredible opportunities that I was able to take advantage of. But in general, I don't fly for a living, so it's usually for vacation. So they turn off their terminal, they walk away, and you stand there vulnerable, wondering, what the heck are they doing? Who are they calling? What lists are they looking at? Here in the United States, it would take 15 to 20 minutes in general for them to come back, and then they always gave me my passport. So one time I said, can you tell me what's the deal? And this gal, I don't know if she was supposed to be able to do that or not, she flips her terminal towards me and she says, because we're having to prove that you're not one of them. And she points to about seven Maria Sanchez, but it's Maria Elena Sanchez and Maria Sanchez de Venezuela or whatever. And I was like, oh. So I started using my middle name, and that ended up alleviating some of the hassle that I've had to go through. The worst time was when I was flying out of Mexico back home. I was on some list that they discovered. That took 3 hours. And I almost missed that flight. And I was like saying, is there anything we can do to expedite this? And they're like, nope. This is how long it takes, and this is what we're doing. And to their credit, they were vetting. And the way I looked at it was, if this is helping to make our world and our country a safer place, oh, well, so be it. So that I know what it feels like to be on those lists. And I can't remember. I don't think I was challenged last year at all. So it's the middle name that works. Also in the news tomorrow, the George W. Bush Library is opening, and it's going to be at the Southern Methodist University campus. And they're saying it's somewhat of a reemergence of him because he's basically stayed out of the spotlight for the time since he's left the presidency. But we're going to have five presidents together tomorrow. They're all flying in today. Obviously, President Obama, and then former presidents Bush, his father, former President Clinton, and former President Jimmy Carter. And it's going to be the first time that they've been together since January of 2009, and that was when they met in Washington a few days before President George W. Bush left office and President Obama was sworn in as president. So they say it's a rare air, and it's a nice little neighborhood to be in, because who knows better about the job than somebody who's been in it. And they say that actually Jimmy Carter is the loose cannon, because of them all, he has consistently criticized all of his successors, even when they've been fellow Democrats. The others have an interesting alliances, as you may recall, that because President Clinton and President George H.W. Bush have forged the closest friendship within the group of presidents. They've worked together. They raised money after the 2005 tsunami in the Indian Ocean that killed more than 230,000 people. And President Clinton has said about the younger Bush, I like him and I love his father, which I think is cute between the two of them. There's something else, if you've got teenagers, you should know about. It's called the Cinnamon Challenge, and don't take it. We'll get into what that is after our conversation with Glenn. And then finally, skin cancer is linked to higher risks of other cancers, and we're going to go through what that means. And then if we have time, we've got the latest version of a blow-up doll for women that's in the news as well. And now I'd like to welcome Glenn Sachs to the program. Glenn, welcome to LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com. Great to talk with you again, Glenn.
My pleasure to be here.
And I was just giving our listeners a little bit of a background on you and what you have done and the fathers and family and stuff, so I'd like you to go into that yourself and also what you're doing now, and to thank you for your years of loyalty for helping me whenever fathers and parenting were in the news, because you were, would we say constant? You were a regular contributor to the news.
Well, I was always happy to do it. It's never a problem. I really think that in some ways the situation with gender issues has changed over the past several years. You know, in the past I've been focused a lot on fathers and fathers' rights in child custody matters and divorce, and a lot of the abuses against fathers in family law. And I still believe that all of those are very, very important. But you know, I really think that over the past 5 years, the economic crisis has been so bad, particularly for men. Most of the jobs that have been lost during the recession have been lost by men. That's why they call it the he session sometimes. I really think that is the biggest problem facing men and fathers today. I mean, there's just a terrible lack of living wage jobs, particularly for you know, people who are semi-skilled or comparatively unskilled. And, as much as our society has changed, as much as feminism has changed us, often for the better, sometimes for the worse, I still believe that very much that for a man, I mean, you can be a great father, you could be a great husband, you could be a great artist or a great cook, you could have a great personality, be loving, nurturing, you could be good looking, athletic, all of those things. If you're not capable of earning a good wage, women are not going to respect you, and society is not going to respect you or take you seriously. And I think there are now tens of millions of men who have been thrown into that situation by this economic crisis of the past 5 years. And the recovery that we keep hearing talk about, I mean, you know, it's really a low-wage job recovery. The middle-wage jobs that so many of these people had, so many of these men in particular had, are not coming back. And I certainly don't want to make it seem that women have not been very much affected by the recession, too, because they very much have been harmed by it. But I do think there's one real distinction there, and that is that a woman can be valued for a lot of different things besides her ability to earn a living. But if a man can't earn a living, he's not going to be valued or respected.
But certainly the courts don't care about those other characteristics that you outlined, be you a man or a woman. It does boil down to economics.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, with custody, I don't care if you're a man or a woman. When you're talking about custody and support, isn't it about the disomaster and the economics of making a family work or not?
Yeah, perhaps I wasn't clear. I was talking more about problems facing men as a whole in society, as opposed to family court. Yeah, I mean, in family court, whatever your income level is, they will adjust for it. And I don't think that the thing I'm mentioning is a particular issue in family court. I think the big problem in family court is that, courts have simply just, and society as a whole has been very slow to recognize the value of male parenting. And I really think it's a change that needs to happen for a lot of different reasons. But another thing, too, is, related to the economic issues I was mentioning, now the American family has changed. And you have a lot of families where, for whatever reason, the woman's the primary breadwinner and the man's the primary caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they're both working, but instead of the old days where the man would work 60 hours and the woman would work part-time and take care of the kids, now maybe he's working 40 hours, she's working 50, and he's taking care of the kids at least as much as she is. So you have situations sometimes where a family will break up, divorce, fracture, for any number of reasons, including the pressure of this economy, and then you go into family court, and then, it's like the 1950s all over again. It doesn't matter what the man's been doing as a parent all these years. All of a sudden, she's the real parent, and he isn't. There are some judges, some courts, some laws that are becoming more updated, but it's still a major problem, seeing men primarily their value only as breadwinners and not seeing their value as parents.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that you think that has changed since you first started working with Fathers and Family in 2009 to where we are in 2013. Do you have numbers about that, about joint custody versus the female? Like, when I divorced the father of my four children, I got 90% custody, but that's because that's all he wanted. He wanted one weekend a month, so there wasn't a fight, if you will. But I would imagine now people are, because of what you said, men are more involved, men feel like the parenting is a priority for them, not just something that they do by default, that you're getting more 50-50 situations or 60-40s?
Well, it is becoming more common. The data on it is sketchy. What society doesn't care about, society doesn't study. And society as a whole doesn't really care very much about how much custody men are getting or parenting time men are getting. But, from what we're able to see, it is slowly advancing forward. And, some of the reason it's advancing forward, too, is that, there are women who are very committed to their careers, you know, they need the man to, you know, provide that child care. They need him to preserve his important role with the children after a divorce or separation. So it's not even a matter of a custody fight or what a judge is going to rule or what the law is going to rule. You know, the modern working woman sometimes realizes that, you know, she needs him in that role, and most fathers are very happy to play that role. If you've got kind of a, you know, the unmotivated father who doesn't really want to spend a lot of time with his kids, as you mentioned earlier, you know, there's nothing that we can do about that. I mean, that's just, you know, I don't know what's wrong with some of those people, but there's nothing that could be done about that. But, I think that's very much the exception, not the rule.
Which is good to know, because I've also been told that in general, 5 years after a divorce, the father's out of the picture.
Well, you know, we hear statistics like that, and I, you know, and there's some studies on that. But, you know, if you actually look closer at those studies and what really happened, you'll find that in most cases, it's not that 5 years later the father had no interest and disappeared. It's that after 5 years of having, you know, little custody rights, having his visitation and parenting time interfered with, you know, having unreasonable financial demands that he can no longer meet, particularly in this bad economy, he's been driven to the margins of or out of his children's lives. I mean, that's one of the big problems, is whenever a father's not there, we blame him. We never look at the other factors that may have caused that. I mean, President Obama is, you know, he's known for this. I mean, he's in Father's Day, a couple of his Father's Day speeches within the past few years, he's, you know, lambasted absent fathers, you know, called them immature, called them boys, called them, you know, all these different things without ever even considering that there might be another reason why they're not there besides them deciding to leave. And two of the major reasons are the family court system and the short-sightedness and sometimes vindictiveness of their exes, who feel that, you know, once they're done with the guy, the kids should be done with the guy too. So there's a lot that goes behind that, but you know, most of the fathers in these situations, they're not perfect, but they do want to be a part of their kids' lives, and sometimes they're prevented from doing so.
Which raises a topic that you first discovered for me, or I discovered with you, which is parental alienation. And can you go through that for our listeners if they aren't familiar with what that is?
Yeah, it's interesting, because there was a major battle over that within the past year, and a battle that did not go the way that I think it should have gone. Parental alienation, or sometimes called parental alienation syndrome, is when after a divorce or separation, you know, one parent denigrates the other parent, badmouths the other parent, and basically poisons the child's mind against the other parent, makes the child feel the other parent doesn't love them or doesn't care about them or is a bad parent or is irresponsible, that the child should not love the other parent, or even that the child should be afraid of the other parent. Sometimes parental alienation can take the form of almost these loyalty tests where, you know, if you love my ex, you're betraying me. How could you betray me by loving my ex? One time there was a film that was, a book that was written about this I saw, where they were interviewing young children who were caught in the middle of some of this. And there was one girl who was a teenager now, but she was reflecting on when she was younger, and she said it was like being in elementary school, where you couldn't be a friend of, if two of your friends were fighting, if Karen and Jane were fighting, you couldn't be Jane's friend and still be Karen's friend, because they would force you to choose sides. That's the core of parental alienation. It usually comes about in the context of a divorce or a separation. Both men and women do it. You know, obviously the parent who has the most physical time with the children has much more opportunity and ability to perpetrate parental alienation than the non-custodial parent does. But both sides do it. And, you know, unfortunately, the National Organization for Women and some other misguided women's organizations have, you know, really, really pushed to keep parental alienation out of the courts, to delegitimize it. And the big battle over it was for DSM-5, the diagnostic of the DSM is the, you know, kind of like the Bible for mental health professionals. And if a disorder is in DSM, it makes it a lot easier to get, you know, to get treatment for it, to get insurance providers to pay for treatment for it, for there to be studies of it, et cetera. So a group of mental health professionals from a dozen different countries put together this large-scale proposal for DSM to accept something called parental alienation disorder and to put it into DSM-5, which is coming out. I think it either came out last year or it's going to come out this year. And there was a big political battle over it, and in the end, they decided not to include it. And I think that was very, very disappointing. I think it was politically motivated to some degree, and I think it was very disappointing because, you know, if you ask people who work with children of divorce, they will tell you parental alienation is very real and it's very harmful.
Now, why would somebody champion to keep it out if it if the issue is that not that it exists, but to include it?
Well, you know, you ask a good question, and at times I've wondered the same. But basically, their line of argument, and you know, perhaps it would behoove you to have one of them on sometime, and they could, you know, explain it better than I could.
And but who do you mean when you say them?
What's that?
Who do you mean when you say them?
Well, you know, the National Organization for Women, you know, declared a campaign, a letter-writing campaign, during the DSM-5 debate, and urged their, you know, they wrote a letter to the DSM committee, DSM task force, asking them to not include parental alienation. They asked their membership to send letters. They really organized a lot of opposition to it. So if you wanted to hear their perspective, I would start with them. But, you know, to try to, at least from my angle, to try to, you know, explain their perspective in a fair way, I think their biggest concern is that it could be used, that false accusations of parental alienation can be used against women in divorce, child custody, perhaps women who have been abused, or perhaps the mothers of children who have been abused. Basically meaning, you know, their scenario would be something like this. The divorce happens, the mother gets primary custody, the two children are now no longer speaking to the father, they don't want anything to do with him. The reason for that is because the father abused the mother during the marriage, or the father abused one or both of the children during the marriage, and now the children don't want anything to do with the father. And that the father will now go to court and say, I'm a victim of parental alienation, these children are being alienated against me, and will try to get more physical time with the children or child custody based on that claim. Meaning, you know, he's making a false claim of parental alienation. The children are angry at him because he was abusive, not because of anything the mother has done. But, you know, he's not going to cop to any of that. He's going to say that it's because she's alienating them from me. So, you know, look, I mean, that's a legitimate, now's fear is legitimate to a degree. I have no doubt that there are men who try to do this, and we do know of women who have been falsely accused of alienating their children. But, you know, they talk about, like, there's this epidemic of, you know, children who are being put in the custody of abusive fathers because of claims of parental alienation. That's absolutely not true, and even some of the cases that they've put forward as examples of this, when you actually look closer at those cases, you see that that's not at all what has happened. So, you know, I think their fear has some basis in reality. Certainly, we don't want to see claims of parental alienation being used, false claims of alienation being used against innocent mothers any more than we want to see false claims of domestic violence or abuse being used against fathers in family court. But I think that they're kind of, you know, they're failing to see the forest for the trees.
Well, and I understand politically oriented things, because you champion your corner, whatever that niche is that you've made for yourself. But if parental alienation syndrome or disorder is in fact something that exists, then whether it's included or not, to me, should be science, not politics.
Well, I agree with you, and that's one of the arguments that we made. And the, you know, the thing that I guess I find kind of troubling about now's position is, you know, they claim that parental alienation doesn't exist. And I just think that's pretty ridiculous. There's no doubt that it exists. I mean, you know, I'd be happy to work with now in terms of you know, putting in safeguards so women are not falsely accused of alienating, when in reality the father has created the problems. I mean, I certainly think that's legitimate, but to claim that it doesn't exist, I think is pretty silly. And, you know, you're right. I mean, it should be based on the science, not on politics. And you know, the social science around divorce is pretty clear that parental alienation is a common problem in divorce and separation.
Well, I've seen it myself with some of my former girlfriends that, two in particular, their husbands left them after 20-some years of marriage. And they let it all hang out in front of their kids, which I found reprehensible. Yes, you're hurting, and yes, you've been wronged, and yes, you've been left. But the kids don't need to see the fallout of those emotions, in my opinion. And I'm no mental health expert. But how could you not help but feel bad or sad or sorry or loyal to the one who's suffering against the one that created that suffering? And I see that as two separate things.
You know, I think it's, I would agree with the first part of what you said. I think it's reprehensible to make those comments in front of the kids. And also, you know, the next time I see a breakup after 20 years where one parent was, you know, an angel who did everything possible for the relationship and was the greatest spouse in the world, and the other one was a selfish SOB who just ran out for no reason, the next time I see a marriage like a breakup like that, that'll be the first time.
Well, I understand.
I think if you actually, you know, in these situations, if you ever ask the guy, the man, how he feels, I'm sure he would have plenty of grievances that are legitimate about the marriage too. You know, sometimes when I hear someone say, "Oh, he left her for a younger woman," in my mind, that's just a woman's way of saying that there were problems in the marriage, and I'm not going to take any responsibility for it. I'm just going to blame it all on him. Certainly, there are men who, you know, are selfish or who have not loyal or who are obsessed with having a young wife as opposed to having their current wife. Certainly, all of that is real, but I think a lot of these are much more complicated than the scenario you just laid out. And also, the vast majority of divorces are initiated by women, not by men. And when a woman dumps a man, I don't hear any of this moral indignation. I don't hear any of this condemnation. You know, when a man leaves a woman, he's an SOB because he left her. When a woman leaves a man, it's, well, what did he do that made her want to leave? Either way, the man loses. And I just don't think that squares very much with reality.
But I think you're missing my main point, which is regardless of why the marriage went south, the kids don't need to be privy to the carnage that it creates, because it will make them choose sides because they of the suffering that they see. I was trying to say that, you know, no matter what or why things went down the way they did, protect the children from the gory details or the filthy details or the dirty details. You know, suck it up and make it work. That's just my personal opinion, and that's
well. No, I think you're 100% right, and I don't think children should be dragged into the middle of what happened in a marriage and who was right about this and who was wrong about that and all of that. I just don't think there's any, I don't think children should be a part of that at all.
Well, and
so
that's where the parental, because in my case, there was infidelity on the behalf of my ex, and being Roman Catholic, that kind of just shook my world, and it was something that I couldn't really wrap my head around because that wasn't what I got married for. But when my kids, the dad said to them, "Your mother's quitting, she's giving up on the marriage." And I was like, really? That's how you're going to phrase this? So they'd ask me why, and I'd say, because they were 2, 4, 6, and 8. And I said to them, it's an adult matter, and when you're an adult, I'm willing to speak to you about that, because I would think that that would vilify them or vilify him towards them if they, like, daddy cheated, you know? I mean, you can't handle that when you're 8.
Yeah, well, you were put in a very difficult position there because, you know, the father should not have, your ex should not have, you know, he's the one who began to try to put the kids in the middle and paint you as the bad guy. I think what you did in not allowing that, not joining that, I think that was very honorable. But he put you in a very difficult position. I mean, he had done something that could, you know, legitimately be said to have fractured the marriage, and then he turned around and blamed you simply because you were, you know, you were the one who initiated it.
I wasn't willing to roll up my sleeves and do the hard work, is how he put it. So
that's interesting. But no, I mean, I think you were right for not jumping into that, and you know, because that's what happens. You know, one side starts it, then the other side starts it, and it goes on and on.
Well, right.
As I said, it's not just women who do this. You know, not just mothers who do this. Fathers do it also, and I think a lot of times people don't even realize they're doing it. You know, a lot of times they're so hurt by the divorce, and that's both men and women. Hurt by the divorce that, you know, this stuff just kind of spills out naturally, and they don't realize how it can affect the children. But you know, there are plenty of cases of parental alienation where nothing's spilling out naturally. The person just, you know, made it their goal in life to make the ex-spouse miserable and turn the children against the ex-spouse. Mm-hmm. And those are the cases where I think it's really damaging to children.
Now, Glenn, if anybody would like some advice about what they should do or expect, do you have contact information you want to share, or where are you now in your career?
Well, yeah, people can. I have a form on my website, glennsacks.com, and people can fill that out, and then I will try to connect them to an appropriate professional in their area. I don't envy people in this situation, and the amount of help for them out there is not at the level it should be, but certainly there is help available. So if anybody wants to be connected with someone, they can just write me through my website.
And what kinds of issues might you be able to help with?
Well, we're talking about parental alienation. There are people who specialize in trying to unravel those and heal those broken relationships. There's a wonderful woman in Los Angeles named Jane Major, who sadly passed away last year, but she did years and years of work with, you know, basically these fractured families and trying to reunite alienated children with the target parent. Her foundation and the work she does is still there. So I know that they help people here in L.A. with that type of problem.
But on the World Wide Web, they probably have resources throughout the country, at least, I would imagine, to help other families.
Yeah. In fact, I should know their website, and I don't. It's Major Family Services.
Okay.
MajorFamilyServices.com. And if anybody is dealing with parental alienation here in L.A., I'm sure they could help you. And if you're somewhere else, you're not in Los Angeles, I'm sure they could refer you to somebody who could help. It's MajorFamilyServices.com.
And I can't imagine how troubling that must be, because all those years that you've lost, you can never reclaim.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrible. And, you know, one of the saddest things that we see is that we see the children sometimes, you know, they're now in their 20s and they come back and they realize what they've lost. Mm-hmm. They realize they've been lied to all those years. They realize that their relationship with the other parent was stolen from them. And believe me, they're not happy about it. And that's, you know, one thing anybody who is considering alienating their children from their ex, I would, you know, very much caution them, whatever you're doing, and eventually the child usually is going to figure it out, and then they're going to be mad at you, and don't do it.
I think that's good advice and a great way to end our session. Do you want to spell out your name so people...
GLENNSACKS, glennsacks.com.
Excellent, Glenn. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Maria. Thank you.
Continued success, Glenn Sacks. And we will at some point be able to put our guests' information. We put it in the show summary for you to download, but also the links and all of that sort of thing. As I said, we're a work in progress, so we'll be able to at some point. All you have to do is go to MariaSanchezShow.com and click on today, Wednesday, April 24th, and then you'll be able to see what it is that we covered and the links to get there, too. So thank you so much for your time. As I mentioned, the correspondents that we visit with, it's their field of expertise that comes into the news. This week has been sort of a reintroduction of the folks that have been so sweet to stick by me throughout all the incarnations in my career, which has been 20 years now. So they give up their time to help edify us about what is happening and why. So if you have young, like mostly what they say, grade school through high school kids are doing this thing, apparently there are hundreds of videos on YouTube depicting the cinnamon challenge. So it involves somebody daring another person to swallow a spoonful of ground cinnamon in 60 seconds without water. Sounds somewhat innocent, right? But cinnamon is caustic. So what happens is it causes choking, throat irritation, breathing trouble, and even collapsed lungs. So this was published this week in the magazine Pediatrics. They said at least 30 teens nationwide needed medical attention after taking the challenge last year. The number of poison center control center calls has increased dramatically from 2011 to 2012. People with asthma or other respiratory conditions are at a greater risk of having this result in shortness of breath and trouble breathing. So I'm sorry, there are not hundreds of videos. There's thousands of videos depicting kids attempting the challenge, resulting in an orange burst of dragon breath spewing out of their mouths. So cinnamon is made from tree bark and contains cellulose fibers that don't easily break down. Animal research suggests that when cinnamon gets into the lungs, it can cause scarring. So there is a teen in Michigan who was hospitalized for a collapsed lung after trying the cinnamon challenge, and she started her own website called NoCinnamonChallenge.com, just telling kids to say no to the fad. She's 16 years old. She took the challenge four times. The final time was in February of last year. She was laughing very hard, coughed it out, inhaled it into her lungs, couldn't breathe. Fortunately, her father arrived soon after, and she was a pale bluish color. He threw her over his shoulder and drove her to the nearby emergency room. She was hospitalized for 4 days and went home with an inhaler, which she still has to use because she gets short of breath from running or talking too fast. She's never had asthma or breathing problems before. So she said she read about the challenge on Facebook and thought it would be cool to try. What we do for fun. And then here's a story that is of particular note to any of you who have had non-melanoma skin cancer, such as basal cell or squamous. There was a study that was released today that found that women with non-melanoma skin cancers were 26% more likely to later develop another form of cancer compared with women who didn't have these skin cancers. In men, for whatever reason, the risk increased by only 15% instead of the 26%. So this is fairly exhaustive. The study included more than 150,000 people who were followed for more than 20 years. And as I mentioned, every day there's, I can't tell you how many studies that come out, and I always try and vet them with, one, how many folks were involved in it, and two, for how long. So it wasn't just like 100 people and, you know, 18 months. So the 150,000 people who were followed for more than 20 years, the findings strongly add to the growing evidence of a link between skin cancer and later development of other cancers. Now, why is this of interest? Well, there were 2.1 million cases of non-melanoma skin cancer in the United States in the most available study, which was 2006. So it's a lot of people. I happen to have a family that my father has been battling malignant melanoma for over 10 years now. So that's the good news, is that he's still with us. The bad news is that because he has malignant melanoma, it went from his head to his shins, this latest episode, and the radiation burnt the skin off, and now he's not healing. He's having to go to a hyperbaric chamber for 2 hours every day for months to help with the healing. And he had a procedure last month that went awry that he ended up being hospitalized for 4 weeks, and it was supposed to be an outpatient, and on it goes. But so because of him having that, and because it's genetic in origin at times, and because we're fair-haired and light-eyed, I've been going to my dermatologist, I think, ever since he was diagnosed. So annually I go, great, she usually burns off something. Then she said, you know what, because of your dad, I want you to start coming every 6 months. So I've been going every 6 months. She keeps burning something off. Now she has me coming every 3 months, and she keeps finding things. And they're all basal, so I keep thinking, oh, well, you know, no big deal. But they're saying that now there's more likelihood that non-melanoma skin cancer, those of us, we're at an increased risk of developing skin cancer, melanoma, and that women with non-melanoma skin cancer were at increased risk of lung cancer and breast cancer. And they say that they accounted for factors that could affect the results, such as the people's ages, smoking, and for women, the use of hormone replacement therapy. So what's the link? The link between non-melanoma skin cancers and developing melanoma later may be due to sun exposure, but the reason for the general increased risk of other cancers is unclear. So warning to self, one, put on sunscreen, two, you should have your skin checked every year, and three, be aware of changes, because that's how it comes about. So the price of loneliness, the human need for touch, the longing for a companion, the need to be embraced, it's being solved by a knitted boyfriend. A Dutch designer has created a pair of cushion men, lovingly hand-stitched by her mother and grandmother. Their names are Arthur and Steve. They come with their own manly accessories like mustaches, bow ties, glasses, and even tattoos. So instead of a blow-up doll for men, this is what they're suggesting we single women might want. This is what the creator writes on her website. My knitted boyfriend is a cushion with a story, a cushion with a personality, a cushion to kiss or to cuddle, to caress, to hug, and to smile with, because this man is always happy. But most of all, he likes to lay down next to you in bed with your head on his chest and his arms wrapped around you. This way, you will never feel alone ever again. With this man, you can be sure he will never leave you. That's pretty sad. Now, having been single for the last 8 years of my life, I can understand why somebody wants to have another person around. Like, it can get lonely. But it's only when I get a massage and I realize, oh my goodness, I haven't been touched. I'm paying for somebody to touch me, that it gets a little bit humbling. So I guess instead of getting a pet or getting a life, that you can have my knitted boyfriend and that'll help make you happy. I'm curious about that. What I used to joke about with, I mean, yes, I date off and on, and yes, I've had a boyfriend intermittently. It's predominantly been not. And why is that? Not by choice, but because my last marriage was filled with drama, and I have my PhD in drama, and I've decided that I cannot tolerate or participate in drama any longer. I know that things happen and life gets in the way, and there's going to be disagreements and arguments even, and differences of opinion, and et cetera, but I can't do the drama thing. And I know we women are considered the drama queens, but you men, you bring your fair share to the table. And so I guess as soon as I see the drama flag, it's a red flag for me. I'm like, nope, I'm out of here. So that may be one of the main reasons. But there was a time in my life in those last 8 years where I'm a cinnamon girl. I'm not a chocolate girl. And so I love hot tamales. And I would take them to bed with me, and I would call them my lonely pills. And so I'd keep them, you know, in the palm of my hand. And this is really, I'm sure, TMI, but, you know, the hot, spicy, the sugary, it all worked for me. So one infamous night, it happened to be a Saturday night, I went to bed with my lonely pills, and I woke up the next morning. I was meeting some girlfriends for Sunday brunch, and I had fallen asleep with the hot tamales in my hand. And so that red dye, whatever it is, was on the palm of my hand. So I take a shower and it's still there. I wash my hands, it's still there. I go to the brunch and you can't help but notice, it's like a stigmata. They're like, what's with your hands, Maria? And I said, oh, it would just be my lonely pills. And most of my girlfriends are married, and they're like, what's that about? And I said, well, it's called hot tamales that you fall asleep with in your hands, and that's what happened. So that was the last time I did that. They announced today that the panel for the Cannes Film Festival, which is later next month, May 15th to the 26th, is going to be led by triple Oscar winner Steven Spielberg, and it's going to include double Oscar winning director Ang Lee and Australian actress Nicole Kidman, who won her Best Actress Oscar for the 2002 film The Hours. And Ang Lee won his director this year for The Life of Pi, and his first one in 2006 for Brokeback Mountain. So it also includes Austrian actor Christoph Waltz, who won his Best Supporting Actor for his Django Unchained. And it includes a Japanese director, an Indian actress, a French actor-director, a British director, and a Romanian director. And the world's biggest film festival, which runs from May 15th to 26th, is going to open with Australian director Baz Luhrmann's version of the F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Great Gatsby, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. So thank you for joining us. Our time is up. We look forward to visiting you tomorrow. And again, you can get all of this on latalkradio.com. This is Maria Sanchez.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.